Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome, everyone. Today, my guest is the writer Gail Brandeis. How are you, Gail?
I'm doing okay. I have a little cold. I hope I don't sound too much like Mr. Magoo.
No, you're doing great. If you do sound like Mr. Magoo, you sound like a very sweet Mr. Magoo.
Okay.
One that I would want to know better rather than the one that was sort of scary in the cartoons, but quite lovable nonetheless. Gail Brandeis is the author of Fruit Flesh, Seeds of Inspiration for Women Who Write, Dictionary Poems, the novels The Book of Dead Birds, which won the Barbara Kingsolver's Bellwether Prize for Fiction in support of a literature of social change. She's also the author of that novel's follow-up, The Book of Live Wires. There's also Self-Storage, Delta Girls, and her first novel for young readers, My Life with the Lincolns. Gail's poetry, fiction, and essays have received numerous awards and have appeared in numerous magazines and anthologies, such as Salon, one of my favorites, The Rumpus, The Nation, Mississippi Review. In 2004, Writer Magazine honored Gail with a Writer Who Makes a Difference Award. She teaches in the Antioch MFA program, is on the national staff of the women's peace organization Code Pink, and is a founding member of the Women Creating Peace Collective. Quite an impressive resume, Gail.
Oh, thank you. It's just me.
It's just Gail, the female Mr. Magoo. Gail, I'll be right up front with you when I say, and I've spoken to you about this, my knowledge and experience with your vast body of literary work is somewhat limited. And while I've known you for a few years, seeing you at various literary events around Los Angeles and bringing one of your poems onto the Nervous Breakdown, I'm not that familiar with your novels. But what I do know about you and your work through my limited experience is that you're a writer with a huge heart, sharp mind, and wit. So with that said, why don't you start out by discussing some of your novels?
Sure. When I gave a reading not too long ago, a woman introduced me, and she found a common thread in my work that I didn't realize was there. And she said that she found that in my novels, the main character tended to be a woman who was leading a fairly quiet life, but over the course of the book, had to sort of break out of her passivity to find her own voice and her own strength. And it was interesting to hear that that was a common thread in my work, because I was not aware of that, but it's kind of a common thread in my life. So I have always been kind of a shy person, but I'm always looking for ways to be more brave and to get my voice out there, even though it's scary. And I guess I'm working through that in my fiction without realizing it. But each of my novels are very different from one another, and I just try to follow inspiration where it takes me. I never thought I would be a novelist. I started out as a poet, and novels started kind of pouring out of me after my daughter was born 19 years ago. And I had no idea what I was doing with these novels. I wrote three what I call practice novels before I wrote the novel that became my first published novel. And after I wrote these first three novels and kind of set them aside because I didn't know how to revise them, I knew how to revise a poem, because it's a nice little economic slip of words, but I didn't know how to revise 300 pages of work. And so I went back to work to school to get my MFA and study the craft of fiction and begin to understand how to approach fiction as a craft. And so I feel like my job as a writer is to really stay open to inspiration where it comes from, and that means opening my senses up, opening my heart, opening my mind, and seeing where these sparks take me. And each of my novels has come from a very different spark and has taken me to a different place, even though they've had common themes. Like The Book of Dead Birds is about a woman who has this unfortunate habit of killing her mother's pet birds. And her mother had been a prostitute on a U.S. military base in Korea and really loved her birds. Her birds were kind of her thing, and poor Ava kept killing them. And so she decides to go out to the Salton Sea during the summer of 96 when there was the worst bird die-off in American history there. And she feels that if she tries to help rescue some birds, maybe she can make amends with her mother. And so that book was really, it took me on such an unexpected journey. And it started off as a poem, and the poem just kept getting longer and weirder and clearly didn't want to be a poem. And I set it aside and then started seeing articles about the bird die-off at the Salton Sea and was thinking that I could tie it in with this weird dead bird poem, but I wasn't sure how that was going to work. And it all came together when I just stumbled upon a documentary called The Women Outside about women who had been forced into prostitution on U.S. military bases in Korea. And as I was watching this documentary, these two characters just bloomed. It was like they just materialized in the room with me, and I knew I had to follow them.
Interesting. You know, the way you were speaking about Book of Dead Birds and how, you know, these birds were getting killed off. I mean, the way you said it seems sort of slightly darkly humorous to me for a moment. I mean, is there any of that in the novel? Because what I noticed about some of your work is there's, and I said it at the start, where you have this certain wit about you that I've noticed in some of your work, and also kind of a dark wit at times. I mean, is there some of that going through the novel?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the title, The Book of Dead Birds, has scared some readers away, and I wish I could tell them it's not all dark. There's definitely darkness there, but there's humor and there's lightness. And that's something that I think I do in all my work, maybe not consciously, but I think that, you know, people see me and think maybe I write about unicorns and flowers, but I'm pretty dark and twisted inside. Not completely, but I have, you know, I think a mix of light and dark, as all of us do, and that comes out in my work. I like going to those uncomfortable places in my work and finding humor there, but also finding beauty there where we might not normally see beauty in a dead bird, but it's there.
Now, your book of live, The Book of Live Wires, which is a follow-up to The Book of Dead Birds, I believe you released that one on Kindle or something, or what's up with that?
I released it on a few different ebook platforms, and that was something I didn't think I would do. But I wrote the book in 2002. It was the year that I found out that the book had won the Bellwether Prize. And the judges that year had been Barbara Kingsolver, Toni Morrison, and Maxine Hong Kingston. And thank you. I feel like that will be the highlight of my writing life forever, no matter what else I do. It's just getting the blessing of those three authors who have meant so much to me just is something I still can barely believe. So it was so affirming for me as a writer to get this honor, but it also completely threw me for a loop with my creative process, where I suddenly felt as if everything I wrote had to be worthy of Toni Morrison's praise. And, of course, you know, first draft is not going to be something you want to show your favorite writer. And even though I knew better, it was freezing me. I was getting in my own way and expecting way too much of myself. And I stopped writing. And I'd never had writer's block before, so it was really kind of scary for me. And but then I heard about National Novel Writing Month, and I, you know, said, well, if people are doing this crazy writing marathon where they're trying to write 50,000 words in 30 days, you know, maybe I should do that, because if you write that fast, you don't have any time to worry about whether it's any good. And so that November 1st, I sat down and spent time with my characters again, and I wrote The Book of Live Wires that month. It felt like a month-long family reunion with my characters, who I still had so much love for and had wondered what they were up to, but I just couldn't access their lives when I wasn't writing about them. And so it was really fun to sit down and just reconnect with them. And I never thought I would publish the book. It felt like something I just wrote for myself to get back into my own process and reconnect with my characters and then just move forward from there. But I had mentioned the presence of this manuscript over the years, and people were curious about it. And finally, I decided, well, maybe I should bring it out as an ebook. And I think I had enough detachment from it at that point that I knew that if the book flopped, I wouldn't be terribly upset about it. And it right. felt, you know, cooled down enough to be able to put it out there easily. And it was to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Bellwether Prize and also to honor National Novel Writing Month, which really did liberate me in so many ways.
Nice.
And so it's out there. I have not done a great job of promoting it. It hasn't sold too many copies, but I'm grateful that I did the experiment and that it is out there for people who are interested in taking a look.
Yeah, and I love also, and it sounds like it was a great experience for you with just reconnecting with those characters. And I loved how you said yeah. that you were able, you know, once you sort of committed yourself to sitting down and writing again, that you were able to reconnect with these characters in a way that you weren't able to reconnect with them sort of in your daily life, that it took your sitting down and committing yourself to the process to do that again.
Yes, definitely. And I sometimes would love to do that with my other novels, too, because I still do love all my characters. And it's that thing where I can't access their lives until I start moving my fingers. So I doubt I'll write sequels to my other novels, but there's part of me that would like to just to see what my characters have been up to. And
I sometimes think that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because it sounds like you have such a great relationship with your characters. I'm wondering if it's sometimes easier for you to get along with your characters in fiction than with people in real life.
That's probably true. In fact, I think that I started writing fiction, and it took me a while to realize this, because I always thought that the fiction came at a time when it just felt mysterious and magical, and it didn't feel connected to my life. I just thought, well, somehow my daughter's birth opened these floodgates. But I'm realizing that I started writing novels right around the time that my mom started being delusional, and I have a feeling that it was easier for me to work out my emotions through fiction than it was to deal with them head-on at the time. And so I think that's probably why I started writing fiction, which was much easier than confronting people in the real world.
Yeah.
But, yeah, characters are great company. Writing can be a lonely process, and it's such a solitary thing. And I'm fine with solitude. I would be fine, you know, just living by myself up in a mountain if I didn't have a family. But it can be lonely, and characters are great company.
Yeah. Now, you also have another novel, Self Storage. I was wondering if you could tell us a little about that and perhaps read a little from it.
Sure. Self-storage is set in the world of self-storage auctions, and I wrote it before. I think there are two different reality series now about this world. There's Storage Wars, and there's one other one that I haven't seen, and it's kind of funny because it was a completely unknown thing at the time when I started writing this story, and I almost wish they had intersected more so there might have been more public interest in the book.
Right.
But this book actually started out as a National Novel Writing Month novel as well. I had been on my book tour for The Book of Dead Birds, and while I was on my book tour, my stepfather-in-law at the time was diagnosed with brain cancer, and the prognosis was really not good, and in fact, he ended up dying a few days later. And but I asked my publisher if I could get an earlier flight home so I could be with the family. And while I was flying home, the woman next to me was really a talker, and I wasn't feeling like talking. I was already anticipating the grief that I was going to be feeling. I was so worried. I wanted to just be quiet. But I shared with her what was going on, and she shared with me that her brother had recently died of brain cancer. And so that gave me permission, I think, to open myself up a little bit more. And I thought, okay, I can talk with this woman and trust her. And she shared with me that on the weekends she went to these self-storage auctions, which I had never heard about. And she talked about how when a storage unit goes into lien, when someone hasn't paid their rent in their storage unit, the contents are auctioned off, but you don't get to actually look at what's in the unit. You can look in it for a minute with a flashlight before the bidding starts, but other than that, it's all mysterious. And I could feel the writer Lee wheels start to turn as she was talking, because I thought, you know, my goodness, think of all of the stories that are hidden behind those metal doors. And so I filed it away in my brain, and a few months later decided to do National Novel Writing Month again, because I was between writing projects and thought it would kickstart a story. And I sat down that November 1st thinking, I want to write about storage auctions. I didn't know where the story was going to go. And what I wrote that November is very different from what's in the published book. What I wrote that November was kind of a meditation on the self, because I just thought of how resonant the word self-storage is and the different ways we store ourselves and the different selves we store inside ourselves. And it ended up becoming a story about our post-September 11th culture and the intolerance that rose up in our society. There's a character who's a neighbor from Afghanistan who my main character ends up really getting involved with. And so it took me to places I wasn't expecting to go. And I love how fiction does that. I love starting a book with no sense of where it's going to take me, and then it just ends up being a real process of discovery and surprise and just unfolding. So I'll read
great
a little bit from the beginning, and I think the only thing you really need to know is this novel also is structured around Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, which is a poem that I just adore, and the whole novel in some ways is a conversation with Walt Whitman's poem. So it starts with one of his lines. I celebrate myself. Sorry, I just can't do it. Walt Whitman starts Song of Myself, the greatest poem in the world, with those three words. I wish I could follow his lead, start the same way, but I can't. The words sound tinny in my own voice, arrogant, wrong. Maybe someday I'll be able to say I celebrate myself freely, even joyfully, like he does, but I'm not there yet. Whitman's book saved my life. Leaves of Grass saved my ass. If it wasn't for that book, I might be in jail right now. If it wasn't for that book, I wouldn't be writing this one. I have to admit it's a bit intimidating to write under Whitman's long and illustrious shadow. I suppose I could try to picture him in his underwear. It worked for Marcia Brady when she gave her big speech, not that Whitman was in the audience at Westdale High. I have an advantage. I've already seen Whitman naked. A series of photos by Thomas Eakins from the early 1880s, Old Man, Seven Photographs. Whitman's name isn't mentioned, but I can tell it's him. Others have thought so too. He was pretty cute for a 60-something-year-old. I love how his belly pooches out just a little, the way my daughter Nori's does over her diaper. I love the way he cocks one hip to the side, a little peevish, a little saucy. I love seeing him stripped bare. I guess I have to strip myself bare here. I have to unload all that's happened these last few months. If I write it down, there's a chance I'll begin to understand it. One image keeps coming back to me. An image of Sodaba, my neighbor from Afghanistan, hunched inside the storage locker. The front of her burqa was flipped up off her face. It hung down the back of her head like a nun's habit. She was turned slightly away from me. Tendrils of hair were plastered against the side of her neck. The wide plane of her left cheek was slick with sweat. That was the first time, the only time I saw any part of her face. I never learned the true shape of her lips or nose, the full scope of her eyes. Just that wet expanse of skin before she realized I was there and pulled the veil back down. The skin of her cheek looked so smooth. It gives me chills to think about it now. But that's not where I want to start. I want to go back to my normal life before her life collided with mine. Back when I had more simple things to worry about, my kids' lunches, my husband's TV addiction, the auctions I attended each week. The auctions, of course. I could celebrate my self-storage auctions. That is something I think I could do. This is how the auctions work. You get 1 minute with a flashlight. The auctioneer breaks open the padlock with a blowtorch or bolt cutters, and you get 1 minute to stand in the doorway of the storage locker, 1 minute to peer inside and decide whether the wrinkled black trash bags, the taped cardboard boxes, the bicycle parts and beach chairs and afghans that reveal themselves in your moat-filled path of light are worth your while. You learn to trust your intuition. You learn to listen to that ping inside your gut that tells you to bid. You learn to look for the subtle clues, the shopping bags with a Beverly Hills address, the boxes marked fragile with a sharp black marker. You learn to avoid certain smells. Mold and mildew are no good. You'll probably end up with a bunch of old sweatshirts and socks that someone put in the wash but never bothered to dry properly, just left them to rot in plastic sacks. You develop a sixth sense for the smell of jewelry, the smell of electronics. TVs emit a hot, charged smell, even if they haven't been turned on for years, while diamonds smell blue, like sweet, cold water. You try to remember that you're bidding on someone else's misfortune, someone who couldn't pay for their storage locker, who let it lapse into lean. You try to remember you're benefiting from someone's sadness, someone's failure, that the money you'll gain from this merchandise will come from someone else's loss. You try to remember there was a self who first put these items in storage, a self who one day planned to take them all back, a self who will miss these photo albums and brittle swim fins and frames filled with dried beans. But you push this all aside when the auctioneer says bidding will start at $1, and your own self muscles its way to the front, and your own hand flies into the air. My favorite part of the whole auction experience was the moment right before I found out what I had won. The moment when I was sitting on the floor of our second bedroom turned storage auction storage room in my overalls and red Converse sneakers, my short blonde hair thick with other people's dust. The moment when I was holding my X-Acto knife over a cardboard box ready to take the plunge. I found few things more satisfying than splitting tape with an X-Acto knife. That first pop of the seal, the way the tape snapped and curled beneath the blade, the fusty exhale in its wake. I loved it. I could have slit tape and pried open boxes all day. That moment right before you knew what was in the box, that was the best moment. That's what I celebrated. Anything was possible. I'll stop there.
Beautiful. You know, in listening to you read and in what I've read of yours, and it just reminds me that you are indeed a poet, because there is such a poetry that's infused throughout your fiction and nonfiction. So, I mean, that's one of the things that I just love about your work. You know, before you were talking about that quiet in your writing, or you being a quiet person, or, you know, that was something you're sort of working out in your writing, something that I noticed when I was reading some of your work, mostly the fiction, that there's this longing, this intense longing experienced by characters, and, you know, as to whether or not they will sort of, you know, get what they want in the end is up for question. But I'm curious, when you begin to write a piece, how does it start out? Is it mostly an idea of the mind that eventually finds its way to a deeper longing? Is it the other way around? Is it a mixture of both?
Oh, gosh, it's so different with each story. Sometimes I just start with an image and go from there. And longing does seem to be a common thread for me. And it's not something that has been conscious, I think. And it's interesting because when I went to, you know, to graduate school, and now that I'm teaching graduate school myself, I learned and often teach that, you know, desire is at the core of a story because your character does need to want something, and the tension of the story comes from whether or not the character will get that. But I think that even knowing that on a conscious level, that's just what comes out when I start to write. And, you know, desire is such an interesting thing. And I did a lot of exploration of Buddhism when I was younger, and it still, I think, has had an influence on me. But they, you know, the sort of central teaching is all suffering comes from desire. And So it's such an interesting tension in my life of, well, you know, does one let go of desire because that's where suffering comes from, or does one just, you know, allow oneself to enter it deeply? And it's a very charged subject for me. But yeah, it definitely seeps into my work, and I think desire really does provide a good fuel for fiction.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because when I was reading some of that work and experiencing these characters experiencing longing, I started feeling that too. So, you know, mission accomplished, you know. The longing was infectious, Gail. Infectious longing. There you go. She is a writer of infectious longing.
Although I don't know if that's what I want to leave my readers with.
Yeah, exactly. I know that combining art and social responsibility are important for you. You know, we've discussed it already. Your first novel, The Book of Dead Birds, which won the Barbara Kingsolver's Bellwether Prize for Fiction of Social Engagement. You know, you're all about that. How do you go about trying to make a difference through your work? And also, if you could maybe discuss some of the work you're doing with women wonder writers and work of that nature.
Sure. And I really can't talk about any of this without acknowledging my mom. My relationship with my mom was a very complicated one, and I'm writing about her now and her suicide, and it's just all very complicated, but I'm so grateful for what she taught me as a young girl about how writing can make a difference, because I saw that growing up, time and time again, if she was upset about something, she would write a letter. And she called these her poison pen letters. And it could be something, you know, like there was one time she had a lunch at a fancy restaurant in Chicago. It was a business lunch. And she was trying to impress someone, and a cockroach walked across the table. And she was, you know, very upset about this, and so she wrote an angry letter and was offered a free meal at the restaurant. And so I thought, well, you know, you can write a letter, you can get a free meal. But then I also saw that she made other things happen with writing letters, where she had been the head of the safety committee at my school's PTA, and she created these letter-writing campaigns where a bunch of mothers would sit in a room and write letters together. And through the power of women sitting down and putting pen to paper, they were able to get a traffic light put at a dangerous intersection near the school. And so that created action through writing. And they also were able to get guns and ammunition out of our local Kmart after some local violence. And so I saw as a kid that writing was powerful, that writing can make things happen in the world and can make the world a better place. And I'm really grateful that I grew up with that model, because that empowered me so much as a young writer. And I've been writing since I was 4 years old, so writing has always been part of my life. And I would write letters to Jimmy Carter as a little kid and, you know, asking what I could do to stop pollution, and got this big box from the White House full of Woodsy Owl trash bags, and a letter encouraging me to, you know, to clean up my neighborhood. And
if I'm not mistaken, when you were 18, you also had an essay on the meaning of liberty included in the Statue of Liberty's centennial time capsule. Is that correct?
Yeah, that'll be opened
well
in 2086. Yeah, it's one of three essays that are in the time capsule there. So, so that's pretty cool. I hope that some grandkids will be able to see that happen, or great grandkids, or we'll see. Or I guess I won't see, since I won't be around. I've always wanted to use my words to make a difference, and it's tricky with fiction because I don't want to write propaganda. I don't want to stand on my soapbox as an author. I want my characters to grapple with issues in an organic way where the social issues are woven into the fabric of the story and aren't me, you know, trying to hit someone over the head with something that I'm passionate about. So that can be tough to find that balance. And I find in revision, the areas where I can see Gail as, you know, activists. if I see those areas, I'll slash them out and just try to find a way to weave that in more naturally to the story. But with my nonfiction, it can be easier to stand on a soapbox as necessary. With the work I do with Code Pink, I'm not doing as much as I used to just because my life has gotten so busy. But for a while, I was writing the action alerts that went out to the 200,000 plus list of members and encouraged them to take action, whether that was calling a congressperson or getting out into the street. And these were letters that I wrote anonymously, but I knew that they would probably have more impact than my fiction ever would, which is read by, you know, a few thousand people maybe. And so that was always so gratifying to do. And now I've been teaching some workshops through an organization called the Women Wonder Writers as part of my laureateship. I'm currently the literary laureate for the Inlandia Institute. And these are girls who are all at risk. Either they come from difficult homes or at risk, you know, for gang activity, or have, you know, just have a difficult circumstance in their lives where they're not in a traditional school program necessarily. And going into these various sites and working with these girls has been so gratifying because I see how life-saving poetry can be, and I see just what a lifeline this is for these girls to be able to look inside, to share their experiences, to sort of exercise some of their experiences in a cathartic and safe way. And yeah, it's I'm compiling an anthology right now of the girls' writing, and it's just so moving, and I feel so grateful to be able to bear witness to
well
them
done.
Finding and raising their voices.
You know, I've read and I've done some poetry workshops in some correctional facilities before, and I think, and it's always been a great experience for me. I think one of the most difficult things has been when it gets to the end and I'm going to be leaving there. But it really strikes me deeply that I will be leaving and they are still there, and they may be there for many, many years. I'm wondering if that sort of affects you in any certain way.
Oh yeah. But the thing that I find is that writing is giving them a way out. It's, mm-hmm. you know, even though they're, and of course, you know, I don't know what it's like to actually be locked up somewhere, and I hope I'll never have that experience. So I can't fully speak for that experience, but I do know that writing can be an escape of its own, and that I hope that people who attend workshops like yours or the workshops I've been teaching will continue to access poetry as a way to look within and to both burrow deeply into their experience but also transcend their experience. I think, you know, writing can be such a healing thing. And in fact, the essay that's in the time capsule of the Statue of Liberty is all about the liberty of the human imagination and the human spirit. And, you know, you think about poets who have been imprisoned, but you can't imprison the poet's heart. And so that part remains free. And, you know, I think about like Anna Akhmatova, whispering her poems to other people so they would stay alive even if she couldn't write them down because she was being censored. And poetry can be a way out even if there's no other way out.
Well done. Well said. Well said. You know, we're getting close to the end of our time, but no episode of Poetescape with Gail Brandeis would be complete without you at least saying a little about your experience with belly dancing. I believe that you are involved with belly dancing and somehow incorporating writing into the experience, or can you talk about what's up with that?
Yeah, I started belly dancing years ago, like 20 years ago, I took a belly dance class and had learned that some people believe that belly dance started out as a childbirth ritual where a belly dancing woman would surround a woman in labor to show her what her body could do. And I loved that idea. And I became pregnant with my daughter while I was studying belly dance. And the last time I performed before she was born, I was 6 months pregnant and performed at the LA County Fair with a sword on my head. And that was, it just felt cool. And so I stopped belly dancing for many years. And after I separated from my first husband, my friend Nancy, who has a belly dance troupe, invited me to dance with her. And it was so healing to return to dance during a time that was very confusing for me. It just really grounded me, brought me back into my body. And so I still dance with her troupe, which is Sahira's Gypsy Soul. And I was invited to participate in an event called Hoopla, which was started by the wonderful LA writer Erica Schickel in partnership with the LA Review of Books. And the theme at first was birth, but she changed it to mothers, and it fit anyone. I was thinking I should do something with belly dance because of its birth roots. And as an undergrad, I did a lot of stuff combining writing and dance. The undergraduate major that I created was poetry and movement, arts of expression, meditation, and healing. And I was always searching for ways to integrate my writing and my dance, and I found that, you know, the body is where those two things find their connection, because I try to write from my body as much as possible, and of course dance comes from the body. And so I was looking for ways to write in a way that could be as kind of muscular as dance, and then to dance in a way that was hopefully as eloquent as language. And I'm definitely not as skilled a dancer as I have been, but I love dancing. And so I thought, well, I'll weave these things together again. And so I wrote a piece that was about birth and about my mom and her madness. The first line was something like, "The story of my mother's madness begins and ends with birth," because her delusion started right after my daughter was born, and then she killed herself 1 week after my three-year-old was born. And so it was this 16-year run of on-and-off delusion framed by me giving birth, because I have two older kids. I have a 22-year-old and a 19-year-old, and then I have this three-year-old. And so I just really wanted to explore birth and madness and belly dance. And so, nice. So that piece brought them all together.
Do you have any belly dancing events coming up?
I do. I'm going to be belly dancing on the Queen Mary next Sunday as part of an event. I think it's called Cairo Caravan. Uh-huh. I think it's next Sunday at 4 p.m. I'll be belly dancing there.
Nice. Now, is that going to involve writing also, or would that just
mainly
be belly dance?
No, this will just be pure dance.
Yeah, those Queen Mary people, you know, you gotta spoon feed it to them. So just start with the dance, you know.
But I do hope I have more opportunities to weave the dance and writing together, because those are my two passions, and being able to braid them together is very meaningful for me.
Yeah, we're at the end of our time, and there's so many more things I want to ask you. I'll have to have you on again at some other point.
That would be great.
Where can people find you online, Gail?
Well, my website, which needs to be updated, is www.gailbrandeis.com, GAYLEBRANDEIS. I would mention my blogs, but I rarely ever update them, so I'm kind of embarrassed to even say that I have blogs. Facebook is really where I update things the most, so find me on Facebook. That's where I do the better job of posting about events and stuff like that. But yeah, you can find out more about my work on my website.
Great. And all your books obviously are available on Amazon and fine bookstores across America.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being on this show, Gail.
Thank you so much for having me. Me too. It's really a pleasure to talk with you.
I want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia, and also want to thank Julia today for her production skills. You can contact Tyson and Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. The show's theme music is by We Voice Sing, speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth and Agony, on Amazon. Next week, my guest will be Jennifer Joseph, an old friend of mine from Manic D Press. Very much looking forward to that. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.